And as the All-Star game approaches, commentator Frank DeFord has been thinking about an All-Star from a different era.
Sometimes the man and the moment seem to come around again. So it is with Bob Feller in this year's All-Star game, which will be played Tuesday in Yankee Stadium in this last season before they tear down that sublime American monument, the house that Ruth built. Feller is not older than dirt, but he is older than Yankee Stadium. He was born during World War I to grow up out by the Raccoon River in Iowa in a farmhouse that lacked indoor plumbing. He's almost 90, still hale and as crusty as ever. He's the last notable living link to our sports past. Good grief! Feller has been in the Hall of Fame for 46 years. He has his own museum out by the Raccoon River. I dropped in there a while ago to visit the repository of those glory days when the fabled Rapid Robert could throw a baseball harder than any other human being. He was only 17 when he came directly off the farm to start for the Cleveland Indians. Feller was the first real, what we call, a phenom. There had never been anybody like Feller, so maybe we shouldn't be surprised that he's the last of his era, still alive and kicking. Yankee Stadium opened in 1923 after the New York Giants told the Yankees they wouldn't share their home, the Polo Grounds, anymore. The Giants' intemperate little manager, John McGraw, had grown jealous of the new Yankee slugger, the glamorous Mr. Ruth. When McGraw learned that the Yankees would have to build their new abode outside of Manhattan, he chortled that the Yankees were going to Goatville, and before long they will be lost sight of. This was something of a miscalculation. The Yankees, reincarnated as the Bronx Bombers, became, of course, the golden franchise. Their Yankee Stadium was huge and a marvel. Now the national pastime had a certified stadium, its own great lighthouse to shine baseball upon all the land. In 1939, the stadium hosted its first All-Star game. Bob Feller, still only 20, pitched 3 2/3 innings, shutting out the best of the National League on one hit, validating his preeminence before a national audience. And now, in his 90th summer, the All-Star game is back in the Bronx, a valedictory for the old stadium. A new and improved Yankee Stadium will open next year, of course, and although Bob Feller never wore pinstripes, it would best honor the continuity of the whole game if the ancient phenom was chosen to throw out the first ball when the son of the house that Ruth built opens next April. After all, the stadium may hold pews for Yankee fans, but it is the cathedral for the whole sport.
The comments of Frank DeFord, who joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. By now, it's well known that Barack Obama started his political career as a community organizer on the south side of Chicago. But Obama had another job before that. It's less well known. He was briefly a financial researcher and writer in New York City for a firm that catered to multinational corporations. It was a crash course in market economics. NPR's Scott Horsley has the second of two reports on the overlooked past of the presidential candidates.
When Barack Obama graduated from Columbia in 1983, he had trouble at first finding a job as a community organizer. So instead, he went to work for a company called Business International Corporation. Beth Neumer Levine was his office mate.
I like to say that Michelle Obama will be first lady, but I will always be first colleague.
Levine and Obama worked on a variety of newsletters for companies doing business overseas. The newsletters were aimed at senior executives and had arcane titles like Financing Foreign Operations or Investing, Licensing, and Trading Conditions Abroad. Levine says even in a company filled with smart people, Obama made an impression.
I always say he was very smooth and smart and together, and I was 23. I felt like a human train wreck next to him.
Obama was even younger, but colleagues say he was mature beyond his years. True to its name, Business International had a global flavor. It was located near the UN, and many of its staffers, like Obama, had degrees in international relations rather than MBAs. It was the kind of place where a young person could take on a lot of responsibility. And Dan Armstrong says you quickly learn to speak the language of the financial professionals you were writing for.
Thrown in the deep end, and you learned a lot, and you had to pretend, I think, to be more of an expert than you were, especially in our area, in finance.
In his memoir, for example, Obama recalls writing an article about interest rate swaps, financial contracts in which parties agree to swap fixed and floating interest rates. His time at Business International rates only a few pages in the memoir, mostly as an example of the road not taken when Obama opted for community organizing instead of what he called stocks and bonds and the pull of respectability. Armstrong says Obama's book exaggerates just how respectable Business International was, with its description of suits and ties and meetings with German bond traders. There was no dress code, Armstrong says, and there was nothing corporate about it.
It was a company full of low-paid, hard-working, fun-loving young people. It wasn't part of this high-powered consulting or finance world. It was a little sweatshop.
Armstrong says he was shocked when Obama quit after a year without even having another job lined up. Most news accounts of Obama's career omit the New York chapter altogether. Levine, his former office mate, says she understands that.
I can see why CNN would skip over it. I mean, a lot of people, you know, had stops along the way in their careers that don't exactly fit the rest of the story. And maybe it was enough of an exposure for him to the corporate world to be kind of like, okay, well, that's not exactly what I want.
Still, researching and writing about hedges and forwards and currency fluctuations did give Obama at least a passing familiarity with the financial markets that's still evident today. Former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin was surprised to learn that Obama had worked for Business International, which is now part of the Economist Group, but he wasn't surprised that Obama was a quick study.
If he has a thought and you disagree, he wants to make sure he understands the other side of the issue. And my impression, at least, is that he's got a good feel for financial markets and how they might react to what government does, and he's got a good feel for it.
Financial markets have grown much more complex since Obama was writing about them in the 1980s, and maybe he would have developed that same feel for the markets even without the job at Business International. But first colleague Levine says it was a good start.
We definitely learned our ABCs of the financial markets at BI. There's probably no question about that.
Even though in his 20s, Obama turned away from stocks and bonds and the pull of respectability, he didn't leave those ABCs too far behind. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
Okay, so we've just heard a little-known chapter from Barack Obama's life. We've also been reporting on John McCain's early experiences, and if you want to catch up on that, just go to the elections page at npr.org.
American voters say healthcare is one of the top two or three issues they want the next president to address. Nearly one in five Americans is uninsured. But for most Western Europeans, the idea that everyone has health insurance is something that's taken for granted. You might assume that people with universal coverage have to give up the right to choose their own doctors and hospitals. But in France, patients have universal coverage and lots of choice. And France is the latest stop for our series on European healthcare. NPR's Joseph Shapiro went to France. Where exactly did you go?
I started in Paris, but then I went down to this beautiful countryside in southwest France.
Oh, you're making me jealous. What did you find?
I found a country that has a universal insurance program, and it's funded mostly with payroll and income taxes. And that universal insurance does pay for almost all the care people get, but not all, so there's also private insurance to pay for the rest. And that extra insurance is affordable. Almost everyone has it. In fact, usually it's paid for by your employer in part or totally.
So how does that compare to what we find here where people say it's often not affordable?
Well, workers in France are required to pay what adds up to about 21% of their income into this national health care system. But employers do pick up about half of that. And so although Americans, we don't pay as much in taxes, Americans do end up paying more for health care when you add in the costs of buying insurance and the higher out-of-pocket expenses for medicines, doctors, hospitals. France's health care system is one of the most expensive in the world. But the U.S. has the most expensive. And here we spend about twice as much per person compared to France.
What accounts for that difference?
In France, they control costs, doctors get paid less, and government sets most hospital costs.
Joe, what struck you most, other than cost, about the differences between the U.S. and France?
I think it's that in France, the sicker you are, the more the government pays for. I want to show you what we found when we spent time with two people in France who are dealing right now with difficult cancers.
Let's take a listen.
We met Annie Hubert at the Burgundy Institute,
a cancer clinic in Bordeaux. She came for a CAT scan, which she gets every 4 months, to check the size of her tumors.
This is the, what is called a day hospital, where you have your chemotherapy. There is a great privacy, which is not often the case with chemotherapies. Often it looks like, you know, the cows being put in. And here, privacy is really important, so I'll show you.
She'd had breast cancer years before. Then 4 years ago, it came back, creeping into her bones, liver, and lungs. Hubert is thin, her skin is pasty, her eyes are bright.
I live with cancer now for 14 years. You're really used to it. And for 4 years, you know, these very regular checkups, I'm used to it too. It's just part of life. If I were 30, I suppose I would see things differently, but I'm 67. So everybody has to die one day. I probably die from this disease. I don't know when. I live with it.
And live with it she has, and as normally as possible. Today she's brought a copy of her most recent book and inscribed it for a friend. Hubert is an anthropologist. After her cancer, she got a grant from the French government to study how doctors communicate with patients.
I'm a good anthropologist because I'm doing what the French call observation participante. Nothing equals experience to understand things.
Maybe it's Hubert's upbeat attitude that allows her to keep doing the work she loves. But it's also, in no small part, thanks to France's healthcare system. Everyone in France gets health insurance. And when someone has a difficult disease like cancer, the national health system steps in and pays for 100% of their care. Unlike in the U.S., you don't need to stay in your job to keep your insurance, nor is there a lifetime limit on how much treatment a long-term survivor like Annie Hubert can get. A young doctor in a white lab coat comes quietly into the room.
This is my doctor.
Marc Deblé.
Here's another thing that stands out about France. Cancer care is well organized. To treat patients, a hospital or a clinic has to prove it meets national standards for high-level care. At this clinic, oncologist Marc Deblé and his team coordinate every aspect of Hubert's care. She can call the doctor anytime with any question or concern. And although this is a country where doctors for a long time simply told patients what to do, that's changing.
Now we discuss more and more with patients, and we decide together what treatment to do.
You're not considered as, you know, an illiterate, something that, you know, you're going to be treated as, you know, like a sheep in the country.
Nor has Hubert had to fight with insurance companies or worry about getting access to her expensive therapies.
Never, ever, for any, which is incredible. I mean, I have friends who have cancer and had cancer in America, and they can't believe it. It's a tremendous difference. Now, I have a son-in-law who has MS.
That son-in-law and her daughter live in California. He has multiple sclerosis.
Even with good insurance, he still has to spend, several hundred dollars a month for his treatment.
At France's new National Cancer Institute, Dr. Fabien Calvo is in charge of research. He talks about something unheard of in the U.S. In France, every cancer patient can get any drug, including the most expensive and even experimental ones that are still being tested.
As soon as there is a breakthrough, even if the drug has not obtained the approval, you can get access for that.
That access to any medication is one reason why France, in a study this year, was rated the best among industrialized nations at preventing avoidable deaths. The U.S. came in last. There's another difference. In France, even most people who aren't citizens are covered by the universal insurance program. Like Brian Coote. 3 years ago, he and his wife, Julie, retired early and moved from outside London to southwest France.
Well, this was an old farmhouse. We don't quite know how old it is, but probably 200 or 300 years. And we've completely renovated it.
From this stone house on a hill, Coote looks across the farms of the gently rolling Dordogne Valley. The Coots rent out cottages to tourists. He's 57 and athletic. He's an avid hiker. But he started having stomach problems in the spring of last year. At first, his rural general practitioner dismissed it as nothing serious.
At the end of June, I'm doing this big walk in the Pyrenees, the mountains, and I had to stop after 3 days and come home. And that sort of said, well, there's something here that's not normal for me.
It took until mid-September to get the diagnosis that should have come months earlier. He had colon cancer. Coote faults his first doctor, but he says once he got to a surgeon, he's received excellent care. Now there's even a nurse who makes home visits. She drives all the way to this farmhouse in the country where Brian and Julie live.
Well, she knows me well. And when I came out of hospital after the operation, she was here every day to check the dressing. And
she also comes to do a blood test just before the chemo. If chemo is on a Monday, she comes on a Saturday to take the blood test.
Still, in a country that's so generous, it's hard to control rising healthcare costs. Last year, the National Health Insurance Fund ran nearly $9 billion in deficit. The government looked for ways to cut costs. Last fall, just as Brian Coote began his treatment, the government announced it would no longer pay for health care for foreign retirees like the Coots.
I did, in the back of my head, kind of think, this is ludicrous. They cannot possibly do it. It means that people are going to die.
There are some 200,000 British expatriates living in France, and their numbers give them power. They petitioned and protested, and in January, the government reversed itself. Many British expatriates say they're here in part because they don't trust the British healthcare system. Brian Coote isn't one of them, but he does appreciate the healthcare he's gotten since his surgery in France. It allows him to continue to live in this stunning corner of the world, even as he battles a difficult cancer. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
If you're one of those people who thinks the Midwest is boring, pay attention, please. In Minnesota, what is likely to be the most expensive and closely watched U.S. Senate race in the nation has lately been consumed by an old Playboy article, a Capitol Hill crash pad, and whether a one-time professional wrestler will jump into the race. The contest pits Republican incumbent Norm Coleman against former Saturday Night Live funny man Al Franken and quite possibly former Governor Jesse Ventura. NPR's David Wellner has the story.
Brainerd, Minnesota may be best known as the mythical home of Paul Bunyan and his blue ox Babe. But at the big 4th of July parade in Brainerd last week, the fuss was all about Al Franken, the Democratic-endorsed nominee for the U.S. Senate.
Thank you! Thank you! Hey, happy 4th of July! Happy Independence Day, son!
Franken's glad handing in Brainerd may have won him at least one backer of his Republican opponent, Senator Norm Coleman. Swing voter Donna Stricker of Pequot Lakes, Minnesota, says Franken made her think twice about who'll get her vote.
He's got an impressive group of people following him today, which kind of makes you start to think maybe, you know, should look at him a little more.
In a state where Barack Obama leads John McCain in the polls by double digits, those same polls have Franken trailing Coleman by up to 10 percentage points. Swing voter Debbie Armstrong of Glenwood, Minnesota, plans to vote for Coleman after what she's heard about Franken.
What I've heard, I don't like. Just a little bit on the radio or on TV.
And what is it that you didn't like that you heard?
I'm not sure. I just know that I had a gut feeling I didn't like him. Don't know why.
It might be the income taxes Franken paid belatedly in 17 states, or the fine he faced for failing to pay workers' comp insurance for several years in New York. More explosive, though, was a piece about virtual sex titled Pornorama that Franken penned for Playboy magazine 8 years ago. In it, he praised the internet as a terrific learning tool that helped his 12-year-old son write a sixth-grade report on bestiality. Back at his campaign headquarters in a St. Paul strip mall, Franken says his 30-year career as a paid wise guy has left his candidacy in what he calls uncharted territory.
This has never really happened before. Someone who's a satirist and a writer who's had a long, you know, and satire uses certain techniques like irony and hyperbole and parody, and those things are very easy to take out of context.
When Franken accepted the Democratic Party's endorsement at its state convention last month, he also made a public act of contrition. He apologized for having made what he called some inappropriate or downright offensive jokes. Franken now says he's ready to move on.
I think more women in Minnesota know about me, the better, you know, this will go away.
But it hasn't for Democrat Gwen Hamilton of Mora, Minnesota. Franken, she says, has not convinced her he's serious.
At first I thought he was fine, but now I've gotten to the point where I've heard so many disrespectful things that he's done and said in his other life that I'm just not in favor of him as yet.
But beyond Franken's past coming back to bite his campaign, Hamline University elections expert David Schultz says the author of books including Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot has yet to make a convincing case for why he should be Minnesota's next senator.
He hasn't explained, you know, why he's qualified to be U.S. senator and what he hopes to accomplish. And maybe he's talked about that, but that's not coming across.
That's not the case, though, in Norm Coleman's latest TV ad. In it, the Republican incumbent's actress wife, Lori, does the talking in their St. Paul kitchen.
They'll say Norm is a rubber stamp for the president, but he's been ranked as one of the most independent senators. They'll say he's in the pocket of big oil, but he voted to take away their special tax breaks. Actually, there is a special interest that Norm will answer to. Hey, Norm, will you take out the trash?
I got it, honey.
Once the Democratic mayor of St. Paul, who later turned a staunch supporter of President Bush, Coleman is now trying to distance himself from the unpopular president to woo independents and conservative Democrats. Talking in the room next to his St. Paul kitchen, Coleman acknowledges his ads don't mention he's also a Republican.
You don't ignore your party. On the other hand, part of what my whole record of public service has been about bringing people together to get things done, and that's what I sell, and I think that's what folks are looking for in these times.
But Coleman's been forced on the defensive by news reports about him staying in the million-dollar Capitol Hill townhouse of a Republican operative who's done more than $1 million worth of business with him and paying only $600 a month rent for a basement unit, rent he twice failed to pay. Coleman makes no apologies, though, for occupying what he calls a shoebox.
Is there some benefit I got having a room that literally you can only fix the bed on one side? You got to crawl on the bed to kind of change the sheets because it's that small. I don't think that's a benefit that most people would even for a moment be concerned about.
Brian Melendez, who heads Minnesota's Democratic Party, sharply disagrees.
If Norm Coleman is accepting an inappropriate gift from somebody that he is doing business with, it is a violation of Senate ethics and is something that Minnesotans ought to care very much about.
Many Minnesotans, though, can't get excited about either Coleman or Franken. Republican Jerry Newman of Wyoming, Minnesota, likes the rumblings people in the state have been hearing that former governor and pro wrestler Jesse Ventura is ready to climb into the ring.
This could be a real giant of a race if Jesse gets in there. He's a crazy person that can create a lot of interest.
I think Ventura could well win.
That's University of Minnesota political scientist Lawrence Jacobs. He says polls show Ventura's prospects are better now than when he beat Norm Coleman and a Democrat to win the governorship as an independent a decade ago.
He's coming in with about a quarter of the vote, and he's not even declared his candidacy. That is much better than where he was in 1998, where he started off in single digits and frankly was a joke candidate.
Minnesota Republican Party Chairman Ron Carey agrees things have indeed changed with Ventura, but not for the better.
The Jesse Ventura of 2008 is not the Jesse Ventura of 1998. Minnesotans know Jesse Ventura, and they're still recovering from the hangover of the Ventura administration.
Getting over a hangover? The only hangover they had was the fact that I beat their boy Norm Coleman, and they suffered a 4-year hangover from that.
After months of refusing to speak with any news media, Jesse Ventura agreed on Sunday to meet me in a parking lot in suburban St. Paul. He still insists he won't announce whether he's running until next Tuesday, the deadline for filing in Minnesota. But when I tell him his rivals think he's simply trying to promote his latest book, Ventura seems to reveal his true intentions. He angrily says he is running, primarily because of Coleman's votes for an Iraq war, which Ventura vehemently opposes.
That's the reason I run, not to sell books. I run because it angers me.
And here's Ventura again, sounding as if he's already made up his mind.
And all you Minnesotans, take a good hard look at all three of us, and you decide if you were in a dark alley, which one of the three of us would you want with you?
It's a choice Minnesotans could well face come November. David Wellna, NPR News.
At night, the moon can appear white or yellow or even red, but astronauts who walked on the moon mostly saw shades of gray. Once, though, a couple of astronauts saw something that amazed them, some brightly colored dirt. Now, decades later, scientists have found a surprise inside that dirt, which may teach us something new about the birth of the moon. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Back in 1972, Harrison Schmitt was walking on the moon when he suddenly saw something shocking. It was a color.
It's all over. Orange!
Schmitt and his fellow moonwalker, Eugene Cernan, could hardly believe it.
Hey, it is! I can see it from here. It's orange. Crazy.
The astronauts scooped some up. Back on Earth, scientists realized that the orange color came from bits of glass.
They're very tiny, the size of a period on a typical printed page.
Eric Howry is a geochemist. He says volcanoes made the glass a few billion years ago when the moon was young.
And these glasses are circular or spherical beads that form when the lava is ejected at high velocity out of the erupting crater and cools so quickly that it quenches to a glass in the air before it falls back to the surface.
The glass beads come in different colors. They've been analyzed before. But Howry and his colleagues wanted to take a fresh look to see if the beads contained any water. Some moon experts thought there was no way they'd find any.
We got a lot of comments like, oh, well, we already know that the moon is dry. We know, we've known this for 20 years.
People thought the moon was dry because of how it formed.
Through a process called giant impact.
Scientists believe the moon was born 4.5 billion years ago when an object the size of Mars came hurtling out of the void and smacked the young Earth. This melted both objects and put a cloud of debris around the Earth. That became the moon. The new moon was hot, like a sea of magma.
The prevailing idea has been that there's no way a completely molten moon could have retained any water.
But Howry thought, well, let's just see. He has an instrument in his lab at the Carnegie Institution of Washington that's very sensitive. He blasted molecules off the glass beads and found that some of those molecules were water molecules. According to a report in the journal Nature, it wasn't a lot of water, less than 50 parts per million. But from this, the researchers can estimate that way back when, the interior of the moon probably contained as much water as the Caribbean Sea. Howry says, this is a problem for the giant impact theory.
Well, it's really hard to imagine a scenario in which a giant impact melts completely the moon and at the same time allows it to hold on to its water. That's a really, really difficult knot to untie.
It's obviously a very new result to say that the moon might have had a significant amount of water right after it formed.
Ben Bussey is a planetary scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. He says, besides raising questions about the giant impact theory, the finding raises another question, too. Scientists have seen hints of ice at the moon's poles in cold, shadowed craters. Everyone has thought this ice had to come from outside the moon, probably from meteorite impacts. But maybe some of it came from inside the moon.
There is a chance that there might be some very old water of the type that they discuss in the paper.
If the moon does have ice, he says scientists could figure out where it came from, but only if a rover or an astronaut went to get a sample. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
We could tell you all morning about some of the wonders of the wilderness, but it's better to let you listen for yourself. Morning Edition is taking occasional trips into the wilderness to listen. We're tracking down wildlife experts who record the sounds of rare birds, lizards, frogs, anything that makes a noise. And today we're going to visit Australia with David Stewart. He had a run-in with an unusual desert lizard called a goanna.
The sand goanna is a large lizard. There are a number of species in Australia. This one mainly lives in desert regions. It's about 7 feet long. It lives on the ground, but it certainly can climb trees if it chooses to raid a bird's nest for the eggs and young. It was a very hot day. It was about 125 degrees Fahrenheit. And this very large goanna suddenly reared up on its hind legs and started making this sound. And I think it's a fret call. I was just too close to it. So I actually got behind a tree and poked the microphone around the tree with this animal about 2 metres from me, making this incredible roaring sound, if you like, and he went on for quite a while. I got my recording and we both happily went on our way. It can happen that if the animal becomes alarmed and you're standing out on a grassy plain, it'll climb the nearest tree. If it's you, it'll finish up on top of your head.
The The series is called Sounds Wild. Think of it as StoryCorps for critters. The recordings come from the Cornell University Laboratory of Ornithology. NPR's Christopher Joyce worked with the lab to get those sounds for us. We'll be right back.